Welcome to It All Makes Sense Now, a podcast where a married couple talks about the books that made them who they are. Every episode, we focus on one book that one of us read during our formative years that the other did not. My name is Lynn Carhide, and I'm here with my husband, Jay DeFacto.
Greetings, fellow humans.
And today we'll be talking about Watership Down. That was my pick. So then, Jay, do you want to give us a bit of a summary of the book?
Yeah, okay, so Watership Down is an epic story about rabbits having adventures.
True fact.
I'm not using epic the way Marvel fans do. I'm using it the way we use it to describe books like The Odyssey or The Aeneid. And in fact, there are several connections between Watership Down and The Odyssey and other epic tales, notably the work of J.R.R. Tolkien, and we'll get to that.
I actually first read a couple of those things at around the same time that I read Watership Down, so the comparisons are very apt for me.
Okay, yeah. So in Watership Down, a group of 10 male rabbits from the Sandleford Warren, led by Hazel, flee their home and set off to find a new and safe place to live, because one of these rabbits is psychic and has foreseen the doom of the Sandleford Warren. So they travel the English countryside in search of a new home. The group encounters another rabbit warren, led by a rabbit called Cowslip. At first, this warren seems like a great place to live. There's plenty of food, there's no natural predators, but soon it is revealed that a nearby farmer is actually keeping all the predators away, and the farmer occasionally harvests rabbits out of this warren. The group decides to escape Cowslip's warren, and they do with some casualties, and they finally settle on a piece of land called Watership Down. On Watership, they establish a new warren. They make friends with other non-threatening creatures, they explore the local countryside, but they have a major problem, and dealing with this problem takes up the entire second half of the book. They have no female rabbits. Without does, their new home is as doomed as their old one. So they rely on the scouting abilities of a bird that they befriend, and learn that there is a large and overcrowded warren to the south, some miles away, called Ephrafa. They send an envoy to Ephrafa, because if Ephrafa is overcrowded, maybe they'll just give up some of their does and, you know, kill two birds. Unfortunately, the envoy is captured because the Ephrafans are militaristic rabbits. In fact, it's not inaccurate to say that they are National Socialist rabbits. They're Nazi rabbits. Okay.
This book is insane.
So very cleverly, the envoy manages to escape their capture, and they get back to Watership, but Watership still lacks female rabbits. They still have this problem. So Hazel, the leader of the rabbits, decides to mount an expedition to try and free some of the does from the oppressive, militaristic regime of Ephrafa. This is despite Ephrafa's superior numbers and military strength. With the help of their bird friend and some quick thinking, the expedition does manage to infiltrate Ephrafa and successfully absconds with 8 Ephrafan does. The Ephrafan rabbits retaliate by launching all-out war on Watership, which is saved by a combination of fighting spirit, psychic visions, and pure daring.
Next on our agenda here, we've got an agenda, don't worry about it. Let me tell you about the first time I read this.
So yeah, I want to hear about how old you were when you read this. Actually, no, the first question I want answered here, I've got questions. The first question I want answered is, how many rabbits in real life did you name after characters in this book?
None. No, that's not true. God damn it. I did name a rabbit Blackberry.
Aha!
Yep. But this is more in the spirit of what you were asking. I can remember the first time I read this book because I have a very specific memory associated with it. I was either in fifth or sixth grade because that was the point in Girl Scouts where I started being a camp counselor at the Girl Scout day camp that I used to go to. So day camp is you get in a bus, you go somewhere in the woods, you do like Girl Scout activities, and then you come back, right?
Okay.
You're just there for the day.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would do a week or two at the camp every summer, which was great. It was like the biggest thing I looked forward to. And then as I got older, I would be a counselor. And, you know, a fifth grade counselor is not really going to help you with much.
It's not like you're leading expeditions or anything, but you're just helping the kids out, I imagine.
You're basically being like an aide to the actual counselor. You're like helping set up for crafts.
I was going
to
say.
You know, you're working with the much younger kids.
A lot of arts and crafts.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. So I started being a camp counselor at this day camp. And one of the things that we did was we gave ourselves camp names that we'd write on a little medallion of wood that we would then make like a little lanyard for, and you'd wear it around. You'd refer to everybody by their camp name.
What was your camp name?
The first year I was a counselor, my name was Ricky Ticky Tavi. I think everybody ended up calling me Ricky, which was not what I was going for. And then the second year that I was counselor, I was Hazel.
There you go.
Right.
A little gender bending.
Right. This book, I don't remember anymore how I found out about it. I can't remember if somebody gave me a recommendation, like an actual person that I knew, or if I found it in the library. And I would have found it in the library in a very specific way. Me and my friends were very competitive about how much we could read and how fast we could read. And I was kind of in the middle. And I always wanted to be kind of on the top. And one of the ways that we would compete was with the Accelerated Reader Program. I don't know if you remember this.
Oh, I know AR.
Oh, yeah. So you would read books and you could take a quiz about the book on a very old computer.
I remember those.
Uh-huh. And you would get a certain amount of points and, you know, the points could do whatever. I don't actually remember if there was prizes or you just got to, like, feel fancy.
I actually don't remember either.
But we would look up our point totals and compare them quite frequently.
Sure.
So I started reading thicker books, bigger books, because you got more points for them, so I could show up my friends. Before I read Watership Down, and around the same time, I was super, super into Redwall, which a lot of kids were. So were all my friends. So I was hard into stories about basically animals inflicting violence on each other and having feasts.
Yikes.
Yeah, and like going on quests and stuff. And for me, Watership Down was like a really pivotal sort of transition book from that intense childhood interest. I also, I'm sure we'll talk about this later, but I bred and showed rabbits at the state fair at around the same time.
Mm-hmm.
I was hard into rabbits. So it was a sort of pivotal moment from these sort of childhood interests into wanting to read more difficult, longer books, more complex books, books that asked a little bit more of me as a reader and had a little bit more to do with the rest of the world. Imagine me as a kid sitting in the library trying to find something to read to show my friends that I was super cool and smarter than them and could read faster than them. We all loved Redwall. I find Watership Down, an adult book that's very thick about rabbits who talk. I was fucking ready to go. This is like the best thing that ever happened to me. So it made a really big impact when I read it. When I said there was this sort of transition from childhood interests to adult interests, some of the stuff that I started getting into were British stuff. I became a real Anglophile around this age. Part of it was my dad remembering enjoying Monty Python for some reason and thinking that was an appropriate thing to introduce to like a kid in sixth grade or whatever.
I mean, we were listening to Monty Python records when I was like 8 or 9 years old.
Right, right. So like our dads both had that brain problem.
Yep.
So I got hard into Monty Python. The other thing that I was really interested in, and also interested in making sure other people knew I was interested in, was mythology. I got really, really into Egyptian and Greek and Roman mythology.
Cool.
And spent a lot of time checking out books that were basically summaries of myths. Like I didn't read, I think the only primary texts that I read were the Odyssey and the Iliad.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't, you know, pick up anything else. I wasn't reading like poems or translations. But I was really interested in those things. And you can see how a lot of that comes straight out of this book with the rabbit mythology, right?
Yeah, so there's a lot of stuff to talk about in this. I mean, no one's ever going to accuse Richard Adams, who's, I guess that's the first time we said his name in this podcast. He wrote Watership Down.
Yeah.
No one's ever going to accuse Richard Adams of not being well-read.
Oh my God.
This book is directly in dialogue with about 50 other books or important texts in history.
I had no idea as a kid. It just completely flew over my head.
And when I say directly in dialogue, I mean that it's quoting 50 other books. There's like 50 chapters, and each one starts with an epigraph from a famous text. And some of them are more well-known than others. Like there's something in there from Plato. and there's something in there. There's a couple of things from Shakespeare. And then there are others that are less commonly read. But they definitely reflect a certain English education, right? A British education in literature.
I think that's completely right. I think as a kid, I must have read this book over a dozen times. And then I just put it down and I didn't pick it back up again for at least a decade. I think the last time I reread this was in undergraduate. So I don't remember paying attention to the epigraphs at all. And generally I don't. Generally they're kind of pointless. In this book, they're not pointless. They're incredibly on the nose. If you read the epigraph, you almost don't have to read the chapter.
That's so Richard Adams finds these quotes that are beautiful little encapsulations of the main sentiment of the chapter to come. Yep. And it's elegant. It's very elegant, right?
I don't know if I call it elegant. Some of them are really elegant, I would agree. Some of them are like, are you fucking kidding me? You're going to quote Napoleon in French? Fuck off. Like, this is a book about talking rabbits.
Is one of them in French?
Oh, friend. There's quotes in Latin. There's quotes in French. I think there might be one in Italian. I was so blown away by the Napoleon one that I actually bookmarked it.
Understood them and didn't.
Oh my God. Oh my God. Chapter 7, The Lender in the River, starts with a quote fully in French attributed to Napoleon Bonaparte.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
This book is wild, man. I didn't remember a lot of things about it, but one of the things that I was laughing about while I was reading it again was, this shit is so fucking pretentious for a book about talking rabbits. What does this guy think that he is writing? And the answer, of course, is what you already said, right? It's an epic.
Right.
And it's very much an epic in the style of the things that I would then go on to read, like the Odyssey.
So I had a lot of thoughts about that exact thing as we were reading it. I was trying to think about what would I call this novel in my head, right? It's not a coming-of-age story. It's not a picaresque novel, although it has some elements from picaresque novels. It is closest, I think, to a pastoral novel, right? In which the idea of the countryside is mythologized as an idyllic place, but it's also anti-pastoral because the countryside and the depiction thereof is informed by a naturalist's observations.
Mm-hmm.
One of the main resources that Richard Adams relied upon when writing this book is a text that was written by a naturalist about rabbits. It's one of the only books, apparently, at the time of the writing of this book that existed discussing the lives of rabbits from a naturalist's perspective. So it includes information about their behavior and information about their biology that you wouldn't find in any other compendium. And so there's a realism under the like epic mythos of this book. So it's not a pastoral novel either, because those rely on these myths, and this book is all about the realism of being a rabbit.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I say that, and at the same time, it's important to note that the book also includes an entire rabbit mythology.
Mm-hmm.
They have
a whole cosmology.
That's exactly it. They have a cosmology.
They have a culture. They have a language.
They have a Genesis myth.
Yep.
They've got a flood myth.
They've got a very specific understanding of the world and what it is and how they relate to it.
Yes. And it's not a religion. It's important to note, I think. It's not exactly a religion, but it is a lens through which they understand who they are as rabbits in the world.
Right. And what a rabbit is. Yeah.
Yeah. And how they have to be in order to keep themselves safe and, you know, perpetuate rabbit kind.
Yeah. In some ways, I think it's a really good companion to Sphere and the reasons that you liked Sphere.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
How come?
I was thinking about this while I was reading it. This is the closest to something that I liked in the same way as you liked Sphere. I didn't really read a lot of, like, we talked about this when we were talking about Sphere. I didn't read a lot of popular science fiction. I read a lot of science fiction that was mostly bullshit. But I didn't read to learn unless I was reading a book for class, right? This is the example of the kind of thing that I would pick up and the kind of learning that I liked to do. I was way more interested less in like math and like, you know, a metaphor about gravity that's really clever, and more interested in people and cultures and their cosmology and understanding how they see the world and how they understand things and how they think and rationalize. And that's basically what you get with Watership Down, is Richard Adams taking a bunch of behavioral rabbit science and then trying to build on top of it a culture that you get to explore through the book. And some parts of that are actually based on like real facts, and some parts of it are based on he made up a mythic folk hero for rabbits because he felt like it.
Yeah.
Right? I think there is a parallel there. It's not a perfect comparison, but this is as interested in science as I get, is social science made up for rabbits.
Okay. Yeah. There you go. that makes perfect sense, right? In terms of who you are and how you relate to the things that you read.
Yeah.
As I read this, there were so many elements of this book that reminded me of J.R.R. Tolkien's writing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Tons and tons of them. And I made a little list here of a handful of them. So first of all, the author of this book, Richard Adams, invented a rabbit language, just the same way that Tolkien invented languages for the different species, the different races in Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit.
I wouldn't say it was the same way. I would say that it's a significantly less boring way.
It seems to be less comprehensive, right? Because Tolkien was a linguist, famously, and wrote a bunch of stuff about his invented languages that no one would read or need to read in order to read his books.
Right. This is more like Adams will sprinkle in a term here and there and then sometimes give you a footnote and sometimes not. Actually, I was very irritated by the inconsistency of when he would decide to give you a footnote describing or defining it. But yeah, you get a word here and there, you don't get like full sentences.
Right, right. There's a little bit, you can sort of infer a little bit of grammar here and there, but not much. It's not comprehensive. So that's one element, right? The language thing. But then there's also the fact that this book is a journey of unwilling, humble creatures, at least at first, right? They're homebodies, just like hobbits are homebodies and unwilling to go on adventures. Well, rabbits are also that, but they have to go on this adventure. Then they, in this journey, they face dangers far beyond their abilities, just like hobbits do. And they come out on top by virtue of, in some cases, luck, in some cases, clever thinking, just as hobbits do in the various hobbit stories. There's another parallel, which I found when I was reading about Watership Down online. Apparently, Richard Adams denies strongly that there is an allegorical content to this book, the same way that Tolkien denies any allegory to current events when he was writing The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings. Richard Adams, who actually fought in the Great War, no, sorry, who actually fought in World War II, I believe, and he says, no, there's no allegory here. I just happened to put some National Socialist rabbits.
I just sprinkled some little Nazis in like you do.
In the book.
Yeah.
But there's no parallel that you could draw directly. And I think he's blowing smoke, personally.
Yeah. Well, his line is that these are just stories that he made up in the car for his kids and his grandkids, right?
Yeah. 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 The fact that the rabbits have an entire mythos that they adhere to and that is their lens for understanding the world, that they have a cosmology, is also very much like all of the creatures Lord of the Rings. Everyone in Lord of the Rings has their own cosmology, right? Mm-hmm. Dwarves have their understanding of how they came to be dwarves and why they are the way that they are, and so does everybody else. There's also there's some really funny stuff going on in Watership Down where the rabbits invent things. They invent a bunch of stuff. For example, they invent first rafts, just a raft to you know, push a rabbit that can't currently swim across a stream.
Yep.
Later on, they actually straight up invent boating.
Yep. By remembering rafting.
Yes, by remembering rafting. Then they learn to essentially domesticate animals for their own benefit. The bird is essentially domesticated by them as much as a bird could be by a rabbit.
That is true.
They also invent things like HVAC systems. Right? Like their warrens are designed in such a way that they can control the temperatures.
Bring in fresh air.
And that's a bit of a stretch because, like, you know what? Ants and termites do that too. They and most creatures monitor and control the temperature.
Everybody just wants to be comfortable, man.
Of you know, their environment in some way. Maybe not most creatures monitor and control it, but a lot of them do. It's not unheard of.
But you're right. I hadn't really thought about it that way. Like, they're just inventing things.
Yeah, like, you know, another 10 chapters they'd have invented rabbit television.
They invented Nazism, so.
Oh, gosh. Yeah. Yeah. So I thought those were clever additions to the story, and they also illustrate something that I really loved about this book, which is that it delivers on all of its promises. As you read this book, when you think, oh my gosh, this thing might happen, it does. If you've been paying attention to the narrative, all of Chekhov's guns get fired. And it's so satisfying in that way.
It is, yeah.
It's the opposite of what you see with a lot of media these days that is intent on being subversive and subverting all your expectations. This fulfills all your expectations. And I love it. I'm here for it. It's so fun to read that, like, oh my gosh, when we get a flash of Hazel's brainwave about the farm, and I think, oh, he's gonna get the dog to fight for them. And he does.
Mm-hmm.
And it's beautiful. Mm-hmm. Oh, it's so fun.
That relates to something that I am appreciating anew as an adult. I don't think I ever would have thought of this or seen this as a kid. But I was thinking about our conversation about The Mandalorian, of all things. We were talking about how the first season and, like, the first two episodes of the second season were really refreshing and fun because the stakes were low, right? I really love in this book the juxtaposition that's so effective between the very epic tone of the book and structure of it and the sort of pretension of the epigraphs and how it's pulling in all of these other, like, great important dramas. And the story is about, like, rabbits sort of painfully hopping across maybe 2 miles, maybe 5 miles of territory.
I looked
total.
It up. It's like 8 miles.
It's like 8 miles of territory. This is a very small story, right? It's about small creatures doing something very small that has absolutely no stakes at all. Rabbits die all the time. And that's part of their cosmology. Part of the stories that they have are about this hero, El Herrera, who, I don't know if I'm saying that right, whose name translates to the prince with 1,000 enemies. And his whole deal is that he's been promised by God the Sun that he's going to have 1,000 enemies. Everybody's going to be constantly trying to kill and eat him. But rabbits are never going to be gone from the face of the earth because they're going to be fast. They're going to be clever. They're going to be able to play pranks and jokes and tricks on everybody. And they're going to multiply like bunnies, right? So it's this idea that it's a very small story, but at the same time, the smallness of it is what makes it effective dramatically. And when you feel tension, it doesn't have to be because every known galaxy is going to end if you don't put the mystery box in the other mystery box. It's Hazel has been so successful up till now, and he just needs to chew through this rope, and he just needs to, like, get away from the cat or whatever, right? Like, they're such small dramas, but they mean so much. And they have you, like, actually at the edge of your seat by the end of the novel. Like, you know, there's real tension there. You really care about what's going on.
Oh, it's riveting. Yeah. I was glued to the page as I was reading this. I love that about it. It's small stakes.
Right.
But it's also epic stakes for the rabbits. And in some ways, the narrative does give the reader a lot of respite from all of the drama because almost none, as far as I can tell, I don't really remember, of the original rabbits that leave the war and die.
No, I don't think anybody does.
Yeah, they all survive. And this is like, you know, rabbits will die from being scared.
Right, which happens.
Right, that's like a real thing. They'll die of just excitement.
Right, their little hearts will give out. It's very sad.
They'll die of being cuddled too much.
Right.
And none of the rabbits in this story die. They're fragile creatures, but in this story, they're resilient as hell.
Right. But they still have such a strong sense of their mortality. And there's that passage where, I forget what just happened, But they're talking about the rabbits and their capacity to feel fear and to mourn, and how they will feel it, but then they have to pretty much immediately just get over it and go on with their lives.
That's
and their
right.
brains are built that way to do that, to right. ensure their survival.
Yeah, I liked that very
yeah.
much.
Yeah. yeah, I thought you might have liked that. Very you.
So the narrative is really satisfying, right? Because, like I said, all of the things that it promises, it delivers on. And you know, as they escape the Nazi Warren, you think, oh, there's definitely going to be repercussions. There's definitely going to be a consequence.
Oh, yeah. At no point do you think, oh, they got away, it'll be fine.
And
no.
there is, right?
Yeah.
And it's great. And they find this raft, this boat, and you think, oh, this is how they're going to escape. And they do, and it's perfect, right? It's like, it's exactly what you want as you read this story. In that sense, it reminded me very much of a fable.
Yeah, that's a good comparison.
The text has this inevitability to it, that once something is mentioned in the text, you think, oh, there's only one way this can go.
But it doesn't leech out the tension.
No.
It doesn't make it less compelling to read,
which is incredible.
It's not
unsatisfying.
Yeah.
For all of that, it's not at all unsatisfying. I really like that about it. I don't think that's easy to do in terms of writing.
It's not an easy thing to do for an author. And this was Richard Adams' first book. Ever.
Yeah.
And he only started writing when he was in his 50s. Like, he'd had a career. He'd been in the military. He worked, I think, in some capacity in the government, and then started writing down these stories and just nailed that part of it, apparently, straight out the gate.
Yeah. Yeah. It's admirable. I really enjoyed that.
Yeah.
That said, the novel is exceedingly British.
Oh my God.
And if you're not an Anglophile, it's a little too British in some places, at least for my taste.
I'll be honest, I had trouble getting into it again in the first couple chapters. I think at one point I walked into the room and I was like, Jay, this book is fucking insane. This is a wild book. And part of my reaction was realizing that all of the characters, all of the rabbits, talk like they're the more intelligent characters in Jeeves and Wooster. Like, these are some British chappies basically saying, oh, what ho, to each other. Like,
yeah,
it's a little hard to accept until you get used to it. And, like, by the end of the first part, I was okay again. But
even the rabbits that are not known for their intelligence talk like upper-class Brits.
Oh, yeah. What I meant was Jeeves and Wooster, everybody is, like, farcically stupid.
Yeah, yeah. Now, this touches on something else that I noticed, which is that all of the other creatures are given accents. And I was a little interested, I guess.
Is the mouse Italian? Like, what's happening there?
The mouse is...
He basically says, it's the spicy meatball.
It's that, but it's also, like, it's a combination of this sort of Italian accent with, like, a working-class London accent.
Yeah.
You know who he reminded me of? He reminded me of the Droogs in Clockwork Orange.
Oh, that's a good comparison. Yeah, yeah.
Now the Droogs language in Clockwork Orange is itself an amalgam of British slang and Russian slang. So it's already this sort of, like, hyper-real sense of authenticity in how people would
right.
relate to each other, right?
Right.
In these situations.
And the mouse, to be clear, is speaking a sort of shared language among all the, like, woodland creatures.
That's right.
Right?
They just call it, like,
it's like,
I don't know.
What do they call it?
I don't remember anymore. But if it were Star Wars, it would just be the common tongue or whatever.
Right. Essentially that. It's like a cobbled together language that everybody can understand well enough.
Woodland. Did they call it woodland?
Woodland something.
Whatever.
Yeah. But it's the idea is that it's not necessarily an especially sophisticated language. I guess it seems like it's cobbled together.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's rudimentary, and it's only good for different species to communicate amongst and in between each other.
Which makes it very uncomfortable when you can associate it with, like, a specific group of human beings.
Well, and then there's the bird, right? Then there's Kihar, the bird. And Kihar...
Who was my favorite character when I was a kid. I love
Kihar. He's, like, really obviously Slavic.
Right?
Or Eastern European.
Right?
In some way. And I noticed a couple of things. First of all, his W's become V's, right?
Yes.
In the sense of somebody from Eastern Europe not being able to enunciate the W
right.
sound.
So instead of Bigwig, it's Mr. Pigvig.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and that's the other thing. The B's become P's.
Right.
And this is also common among some Eastern European languages, not even necessarily as far north as, say, even the Ukraine, like in Turkey. This is very common because you've got the influence from Arabic, where you don't have a P sound in Arabic. You've only got Bs. And in Turkey, you do have the P sound, but it's very easy to get them confused if you're a non-native speaker. And so it's like, okay, Kihar is a gull. He's a black-headed seagull, and he is from Eastern Europe, I guess? Why is he from Eastern Europe?
I think the subject is very clear.
Why does he talk this way?
Kihar is a Dracula.
He can fly. Case closed.
Right? He has to hide underground during the day. What do you want?
There's also one line in this book that made me tug my collar. And it's a comparison near the end of the story of rabbits not understanding what they are seeing to, and I'm quoting a phrase here, to simple African tribes.
Yes. Yep.
Not understanding a plane or not being able to remark on a plane in the way that they would remark on and in fact go crazy for a wheeled cart, because that was more in line with their experience and something that they could actually appreciate.
It's just like the documentary historian Jerry Diamond letting us know that the Aztecs literally could not see the ships.
Right, yeah, yeah. You know, they didn't have a word for boat, so they couldn't see it. Yeah, exactly. And so there's a few elements like that in this book where it's like, this is definitely written by an English dude of good breeding, right?
Yeah.
Like of means and of education.
I didn't remember the part you just mentioned, but there was a part early on where he talks about primitive man and primitive societies in ways that were also similarly uncomfortable. There was not as much of that as I would have expected from a book of this age written by the person it was written by.
Yeah, I was really happily surprised at that.
Yeah,
because
it was nice.
You could get some very uncomfortable stuff. We got lucky with Richard Adams in this book because there's very little of that.
I mean, some of Tolkien's shit is worse.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So notably, if you recall, at the Battle of Pelennor Fields in the third Lord of the Rings book, in the Return of the King.
I don't recall it because I could never get through it.
Tolkien describes the, like, I think literally like the dark-eyed, big-lipped Eastern hordes or something like
right,
that.
Right, which is like, at least nobody's doing that in
yikes.
This book.
Yeah. Now, he was writing, you know, 30, 40 years earlier. This book, Watership Down, came out in the 70s, early 70s. And so, you know, there's at least some, you know, a couple generations difference there between Tolkien's writing and this, a generation and a half. But yeah, I was pleasantly surprised that there wasn't as much of the, like, spicy racism, the sort of, like, casual, spicy British racism.
Right.
Now, as we have said, the book is very, very British, right? And part of that comes through in stuff like this, and the other part, I think, comes through in the dialogue of the characters and in the quotes at the beginning of each chapter, in all the epigraphs, where it's like, oh, this is absolutely like stuff that you would find in the curriculum of a British public school.
Right.
Where, and this is important for our American listeners, where public school in England is private.
Right.
Okay.
The whole time you're reading this, you're like, oh, did you go to Oxford? Did you? I don't know where he went, but it was somewhere like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I noticed that and was, it made me wrinkle my eye a little bit, wrinkle my eyebrow.
So there's two directions I could go from here. One is continuing talking about some of the, like, the craft of the writing, and another one is talking about some of the social commentary in the book. Which adventure do you want to choose first? Because we'll get to all of them.
Let's talk about the writing.
So, we've praised the writing overall. We haven't mentioned this, but the chapters are very short, and the book clips along. I think that the pacing is pretty good overall. There's not a lot of moments to get bored. There's a lot that happens. There's nearly always something going on. Like you said, everything that gets set up then happens. It's very successful. There's good tension. For me, I felt like though there was really only good tension in the latter part of the book. I felt on rereading this that the first two parts were very perfunctory, and some of the imagery that should have been really arresting and that I imagined being arresting just really wasn't. It felt flat in a way that was kind of disappointing, in part because the book was just kind of clipping along and had somewhere to get.
Yeah, interesting. I noticed some of what you're saying about the imagery as well, but I attributed it to the fable-like quality of the text, right? Where a lot of the stories that we know of as fables describe action in a rather perfunctory way.
Yeah.
Things just kind of happen and
you're told that they happen.
And then there's a consequence and then there's a moral, right? Like that's every fable we've ever heard.
I think that's about right. I think what I'm missing from a lot of the narrative was the sort of like emotional impact in the interior life of the characters. And there really isn't any. You get a little bit of Hazel's because he's kind of the point of view character. But everybody else's character, even though you kind of can tell some of their habits apart, there's not a lot of there.
You know, that's a good point. There isn't a whole lot of interior life of the mind of these rabbits.
Right.
There is some for a few characters, but it's sparse, and it's certainly not where Richard Adams wanted to concentrate when he wrote this narrative.
Right. And so I think for me, that's why the fourth and final part is the most effective, is because I've spent, you know, 300 some pages with these characters at this point, and I'm bought in and I care about the success of the Warren, and it's just very exciting, all the stuff that happens with the dog and everything. And that works, both the fact that I've already built up this investment in the characters and the events, and the fact that the events themselves are exciting, work in this very perfunctory style. Whereas I think earlier in the book, it wasn't as successful because I hadn't built up that sort of reservoir of caring that could function for me in a way that the text itself didn't.
Yeah, I think that's apt. That's a good point. I can see how that dynamic would exactly play out that way.
But I think it's also just speaking to my preferences as an adult reader, right? This is no longer the kind of book that I turn to and enjoy. I mean, I enjoyed it, but it's not the kind of thing that I would seek out in the same way that I might have when I was younger.
Right. Well, you know, one thing to point out about that is that this book isn't about the psychology of rabbits.
No.
It's about the adventures of rabbits.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, their psychology, though we get a few glimpses of their shared psychology, always remains, or for the most part, remains generalized rather than specific.
Right.
Like we don't get a lot of the internal thoughts of, for example, Fiverr, who is the psychic rabbit, whose internal thoughts would probably yield a lot of interesting things to write about.
You can get and some for readers to read about for some of those moments, right?
We only get a few tastes of his internal life, and only when he actually vocalizes them to other rabbits, and that's in the process of adventures happening. So it's not about rabbit psychology.
Mm-hmm.
Now, every section of the book does have one chapter that is a rabbit story, a story that the rabbits tell each other.
I love those so much.
About their mythic figure. What do we call it? They're like, their folk hero.
Yeah.
Each of the chapters has a story that they tell each other, that the rabbits tell each other about their shared folk hero rabbit. And those stories are essentially larger epigrams,
mm-hmm.
because they mirror the action that's going on and they foretell things. There's lots of foreshadowing.
The rabbits will tell each other a story and then be inspired to do something by the story.
Yep.
If it wasn't executed so well, it would be boring. But it isn't. In fact, I think these are some of the most charming parts of the book.
Oh, they were great. So they lean into being fables more than the rest of the story, right? Even though the whole story has this tone, these four chapters lean into it more than anything else. Like, everybody knows the story of, what is it, the fable of the weasel that gets into the larder through the little hole and eats too much food and gets too fat to get out.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And then is caught and, you know, oh my gosh, it's hubris. Mm-hmm. It's our old friend hubris. Once again. And that's what these stories are like. Now they're more in depth. They tease at the idea that the rabbits have this like giant shared monomyth culture.
Right.
Right, that like all rabbits know by virtue of being rabbits.
It's such a cozy idea too, like to imagine them in their warrens in the dark in winter exchanging stories about this folk hero.
Speaking of which, can we talk for a moment briefly, just as an aside, about, as I was reading this, I started to empathize with rabbits so much.
So much!
I don't mean the rabbits in the book. I mean real life
real
rabbits.
Actual rabbits.
When I go on a walk in the neighborhood, or if I'm in a field and I see a rabbit, I'm going to think of this book now,
mm-hmm.
because I was already thinking of those real rabbits that I have seen in my life while reading this book and thinking about their interior lives and the troubles and tribulations of just getting to the next meal or the next safe warren.
Right.
You know, in a neighborhood where, like, man, people drive down our street 30 miles an hour. That's really dangerous for a rabbit. By the way, the rabbits have a word for street and car.
Right.
And it's a rabbit word. It's not an English word.
You know, this is going to sound like a very stupid thing to say, but it's such a rabbity book. You know? It's just the evil warrens that they go to at the same time that, like, come on, Rich. They're definitely allegories. At the same time that they're not allegories, they make sense for rabbits, right? Like, what would you imagine would happen if a farmer started essentially farming a wild warren? How would the rabbits make sense of that? What would they think? Why wouldn't they go away? And you can kind of extrapolate from that what Cowslip's warren is like. Similarly, with the Nazi warren, with Woundwort, you can say, okay, what would happen if a rabbit actually understood some of the, like, reasoning and cause and effect of what killed off his last warren and could, like, change his behavior around that. And what you get kind of makes sense. So, like, I like that what he's doing is creating this understanding of, like, what rabbits are and how they think in your head, such that you can see a rabbit sitting in somebody's lawn and have this, like, oh, he's out for his evening soul play. Like, it's just, I don't know. There's something really fun about it.
Yeah, and
but it's also very serious and epic.
Well, you know, it reminded me of a lot of shows or movies, I guess, that I watched as a kid. It reminded me of a lot of movies that I watched as a kid where small creatures have these grandiose and epic adventures and lives. You remember the Fievel movies?
Yeah.
Or the
yeah.
Rescuers movies.
Oh, I loved those, surprisingly.
Right.
Not.
I can see also that, I mean, this novel, had I read it as a kid, it would have appealed to me along a number of axes. And one of those is how my entire life I have had a deep and abiding love of National Geographic cutaway drawings.
Yes.
Of things like rabbit warrens.
This book is like the book form of a cutaway drawing.
Yes. Or ant farms.
Yeah.
Or anything along those lines where there is...
Oh, that's my shit. Yeah.
where there's anything along those lines where we get a view into an entire world that has structure,
mm-hmm.
that we have no access to, basically.
Yeah.
Right? We can look at it in books and in pictures and stuff, but we have no access to it.
You can't touch it. You can't fully understand it or participate in it.
And you can imagine, right, as a kid thinking... The rabbits, they got a society. You know, the rabbits live in a society. So do the ants in that ant farm. And all of the creatures that live in these large groups. And now we, you know, like, you know, I'm an adult now and I know that the term is eusocial. And eusocial animals live like this. And,
right,
you know,
sure.
They're, it's just one of the ways that animals self-organize. It doesn't have anything to do with culture and society. It's nature.
But what if it did? What if you could imagine it did?
But it's so fun to imagine
yeah.
that they've got these cultures and that they've got not just organization within their group for survival and for proliferance, but in addition, they've got culture. They've got literature, essentially.
Yeah.
That they tell us. It's an oral literature,
yeah.
but they've got a literature. Oh, man, I would have loved that as a kid.
Yeah.
Would have been all about that as a kid. And so, I can totally see young Lynn just leaning into that aspect of this and never after looking at a rabbit without thinking of the rabbits in Watership Down.
I wonder if that one is psychic. Yeah.
Yeah, right?
Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly what happened. I guess it's safe to say that you liked the book, huh? I didn't ask you that.
Oh, yeah, no, I did like it very much. You're right that it does start out a little bit perfunctory,
mm-hmm.
but the characters really do grow on you,
yeah.
or at least they did to me. I'm trying to imagine what it would be like to read this book and not like it.
I think it would be easy to be turned off by the Britishness or not be able to get through that first hump of things just being very perfunctory and kind of hard to care about.
I guess so, but there's so much action right away.
Like, the whole idea that a rabbit could see this sign and have this sort of like psychic vision of what it means, and like the there's that moment where there's that moment at the end of the book where Hazel is basically hallucinating. And he hallucinates that sign and like the characters wiggling and taunting him and coming to life.
The letters on the sign.
Yeah, the letters on the sign. And it's just, I don't know, there's something so cool about some of those images. There's something really haunting about Fiverr's first premonition. And I mean, I found it easy to get back into again, but it did take me a little bit.
Yeah. I guess we also should note that their first Warren, Sandleford Warren, is destroyed by humans. This was the destruction, the doom that Fiverr predicted. Now, he couldn't predict what would happen. He just knew that the place was doomed.
And they had to get out.
And apparently what happens is, you know, a contractor comes through and poisons the Warren, right? Spreads poisonous gas in the Warren. And only a couple of rabbits manage to escape. And then, after the rabbits and the Warren are all dead, bulldozers come through and they tear up the earth, and there is no land left for rabbits at Sandleford Warren once the men are done with their work.
There's a couple of sides in the book that are exactly what you might be expecting, having heard that description, where Adams takes a pretty heavy hand talking about how humans kill basically for their convenience and for fun.
Yeah.
Whereas the other enemies, the other of the thousand enemies that rabbits have, basically just kill because they need to eat. It's not wasteful. It's part of life, right? But humans are unique and kind of terrible in that way.
Yeah, he makes the point very explicitly that humans have a special capacity for death and destruction.
And cruelty. Right. Just pointless cruelty. Yeah.
It is explicit. It's not even subtext. It is actual text in the book. And then, at the very end of the book, Hazel is saved by a human.
Who also speaks in impenetrable dialect.
who speaks in a really, like, country accent. And it's important to note that because humans in this book are depicted as both destroyers and saviors, the distinction we can make is that the destruction that humans cause in the book is absolutely intentional, and the saving that they do is purely incidental.
Yeah.
Right?
So literally by the whim of a child.
Yes.
Yeah.
And she's not doing it to be kind to the rabbit.
No, she's doing it to get the attention of literally Richard Adams.
Right.
Who put himself in the book.
Right. Yeah. There's a Dr. Adams in there, and, you know, whatever. And so in some ways, you know, you could read this and think that Richard Adams himself had a fairly negative appraisal of humanity. Maybe a little bit of a stretch, but, you know, he also fought in World War II.
Yeah, like I don't know how you're going to have a rosy view of humanity after having that be one of your early formative experiences.
Yeah.
Well, I think there's two other things that I wanted to talk about. One is that I think that Hazel's style of leadership rubbed off on me fairly unconsciously, even though, yes, I literally named myself Hazel. I don't think I understood exactly what I was taking away from that. And in a way, he's a really healthy model of leadership, right? We were talking earlier about the way that he's the leader not because he's the biggest or the strongest or the fastest or the smartest. Those are other rabbits. He's the leader because he can recognize those qualities in other people and knows how to get them all to work together. And he's also the leader because he's willing to take risks for everybody else. And I think that that is a much healthier understanding of leadership and what it means to be a leader or what you do with power than in most of the other stuff that I was reading. Especially if you take the Tolkien example again, even though, you know, the whole thing is that the smallest person can change the world and the hobbits are everything. Every other character who's not a hobbit is, like, fated to do shit or has incredible magic powers, right? And a lot of fantasy is very much like, oh yes, even the humblest amongst us can do X, Y, or Z, but it always turns out, like, fucking Star Wars, everyone is a goddamn Skywalker. You're a Skywalker or you're a corpse. Like, that's pretty much what it comes down to. You either are born important or you're not.
Harry Potter.
Yeah, yeah. I really like the idea that Hazel is basically just some guy that can kind of like figure it out and cobble it together.
Yeah. Yeah, I appreciate that. It's very proletarian.
Yeah.
I was smiling while Lynn was talking there because I had a similar thought about Lynn relating to the model of Hazel's leadership in this book, like explicitly.
Really?
Yes. Because one of the things that you're very good at is getting people to work together and as a leader, encouraging them in ways that allow them to make the most of their skills. And that's exactly how Hazel leads his group. He's not leading by force, he's leading by encouragement and example. And that's exactly how you, you know, lead people in real life when you're in roles of leadership.
It's certainly how I aspire to, anyway. On the flip side, one of the things that I didn't like about this book, well, I wouldn't say that I didn't like it. Let me just say what I think. I really appreciate the benign sexism of this book. I appreciate how benign it is. That's one of the things that stuck out to me as a kid, and that also I remembered again. There's a number of does in the book. They are named. They are described in very similar ways to the bucks, the male rabbits, fairly perfunctory, right? They each have like a trait each. They have dialogue. They say things. They're distinct individuals. They're just not important to this story. And they pretty much show up on the sidelines when it's convenient. And the story isn't about how does aren't important. The story is about how does are absolutely important. You have to have them in order to have a future for your Warren. I've seen the buck's attitude toward does be described as basically mechanical, or saying that the, you know, the does are basically baby factories. I don't think that's the attitude that the bucks take at all. They're just not important to the story. That's it. They're just not, it's not really a story about them as individuals or actors.
That's the crux, right? Because yeah. it's not a story about female rabbits. Richard Adams just populated his book with a bunch of male rabbits.
Right.
And then he made the entire third and fourth acts of the book depend on the fact that he had populated the story with entirely male rabbits.
Right. And when the female rabbits show up, there's one of them that's psychic and has an important vision that ends up being fulfilled at the end of the book that kind of gives Hazel the idea that he uses to save everybody. But at the same time, I think it's an interesting example of the ways that human beings can try to tell a story that's objective or scientific. You could very easily make the argument that it would be inappropriate for one of the does to have joined them at the beginning and made this big journey, because that's just biologically something that does don't tend to do, whereas young bucks do this in nature.
Apparently, though, the opposite is true.
Oh, really?
What I was reading online is that new warrens are typically founded by female rabbits.
So this plays into my my point even better, which is that people will try to tell a story that they think is like objective or based in science, but what actually ends up is they just replicate the relationships and social structures of their time in the novel, right? So if you have a guy whose formative years were in World War II, and he's basing some of his characters on officers that he knew, women exist and are important, but they're not like an important part of that experience for him. He doesn't see the way that they are actors or actually shaping the experiences that he has. You're missing half of the world, essentially.
Yeah.
And that gets reflected in the stories that you write.
Yeah.
Where if you actually look at rabbit life, it would be absolutely ridiculous to try to tell a story about a species like a rabbit and not have the does be an important part of it.
Right.
So I appreciate that the sexism was just women are invisible and not women are actually like terrible and catty and shouldn't have been along in this because they would have just wanted to go shopping for little rabbit shoes. Right.
Right. Yeah.
Like it wasn't poisonously mean or cruel. It was just like feeling myself be put on a shelf. And if I have to have a sexist British novel about rabbits, that's the way that I would prefer to go.
Yeah, I noticed that as well. I think it is fairly benign. It's not malicious. It doesn't have the sort of poisonousness that a lot of other, even casual misogyny has in literature, particularly in books that involve fantastical things happening, right?
Right.
Talking rabbits with magic powers. But yeah, it's fairly benign. They're just not there.
Yeah. And if you think about it for half a goddamn second, it doesn't make any sense at all that they're not there. But at least you're not being insulted about it.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I noticed that as well. But I also came down on the side of it's not repulsively misogynistic.
Yeah.
It's just
mildly misogynistic.
Yeah, it's just sexist in the sense that, like, he's not telling a story about women.
And it's easy for me to ignore in the same way that he ignores me.
Right, yeah.
So, all comes out in the wash. There's a part of this book that has a very outsized presence in my memory. I was really surprised to find that it's just like a pretty perfunctory footnote. It played a big role in making me pro-choice as a young woman. I was going to like Catholic schools and was in a very Catholic family. So the footnote is just about, it's about Ephrapha, and it's about how the does aren't having litters. And there's a footnote that explains that this happens in rabbits when a warren is overcrowded and there's not enough resources to support a litter. What'll happen is a doe will get pregnant, but the doe will absorb the litter back into her body if the conditions aren't right to give birth. Which sounds like a pretty like straightforward fact about animals, but that rocked my world as a kid. The idea that somewhere in nature, naturally, you don't have to give birth if it's not the right thing to do. If you can't support the child that exists in the world, kind of opened a door in my brain. I remember thinking for an embarrassingly long time after that, when I would think about the morality of abortion and the morality of birth control, I would think back to this part in Watership Down and be like, well, in nature, does can just reabsorb the baby if it's not the right time. Why can't humans do that? Oh, we can do that, you know, artificially. We can do that with medicine. So it must be fine. Which is kind of an insane way to work around to that idea. But that was the tools and the language and the ideas I had at the time.
I don't think that's insane at all. I think that that's exactly the way, you know, a young kid might start to incorporate some of these ideas into their worldview. I think it makes a lot of sense.
The whole conversation about what is and isn't natural and what is and isn't in God's plan was very much part of my science education growing up. Like our whole sex ed thing, I've told you about this before, but our sex education was a pamphlet that for the first 5 chapters was about how much God loves you and therefore you shouldn't do anything that would make God unhappy, right? God loves you so much. It's kind of wild what your brain can do when it's exposed to ideas that are outside of the very narrow confines of what you're being given.
Yeah, yeah. You come up with some really creative ways of reconciling the different influences that are going on, right, in your head as a kid. Yeah. You got your parents telling you all this stuff, and you've got school telling you all this stuff, and then you encounter these ideas in books, and your brain is off to the races trying to reconcile these things.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah, it was a really important book for me in a lot of ways. I'm glad that it holds up. It was the book that I said was my favorite book for a long time when I wanted people to like be impressed with me versus saying what was actually my favorite book, which was whatever stupid fantasy schlock I'd read most recently. And I'm happy to see I didn't embarrass myself too badly. All right, so what are we going to read for the next episode? Do you have a pick yet?
Yeah, I think the next book we're going to do, it's a book called Henry Reed, Inc. And it's about a young boy who is a very enterprising young man who spends the summer at, I think, his grandparents' place in the countryside and has adventures in the countryside.
All right, more countryside adventures.
Yeah, yeah. Doing a lot of pastoral stuff, I guess.
How British is this one?
Not at all. It takes place in, I believe, New Jersey.
Thank Christ.
Yeah, yeah. rural New Jersey. So, like, you know, one of the townships out away from Newark or wherever.
Cool. All right, well, I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah.
Any final thoughts?
I just would like to say that having read Watership Down now, it all makes sense now.
God damn it. All right. All right. Thanks for listening. Until next time.